You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges. And follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
So good evening. Bonsoir en goedenavond. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, the colleagues and friends, it is with great pleasure that I welcome you all today to this conference within the Royal Military Academy. And thank you for having accepted your invitation, for having accepted the Brussels weather, and for having accepted the Brussels traffic jam, and to come to this place and enjoy tonight's presentation. You know that this venue is well known to our speaker of the day, Mr. Steve Killelay, founder and president of the Institute for Economics and Peace, who will present to us tonight the 2015 Global Peace Index and launch it in Brussels tonight. This presentation is the third of its kind after the previous announcements of the Global Peace Index and the Global Terrorist Index 2014 in June and November last year. All these conferences have been, as today's, organized with the cooperation of friendly institutions. So the co-organizers for tonight are the Military Academy, the Royal Irish Institute for Defense, the Global Governance Institute, Friends of Europe, the Atlantic Treaty Association, and the EU-Atlantic Association of Belgium. We are honored to work together in support of the message of peace delivered by the Institute for Economics and Peace. This institute is the world's leading think tank dedicated to developing metrics to analyze peace and to quantify its economic benefits. It has been ranked amongst the 15 most influential think tanks in the world in 2014. It is an honor and a privilege to present today's speaker. But I have to say that I feel very humble and thankful in front of such an audience. Today, about 200 people have registered, coming from not less than 50 different countries, from all continents. So not only the Peace Index is global tonight, so too is the audience. I would like to express special thanks to Mr. Amaury Groenen, diplomatic advisor to the VUB, and his lovely wife, Carolina, for being here tonight. Also to Dr. Stephen Hill, NATO legal advisor, and his team to be here tonight. To Dr. Joachim Koops, director of the Global Governance Institute. To Mr. Arno Le Grel, director at Federgon, and also president of Mars et Mercurius Brabant Bruxelles. And finally, to Professor Irnerio Seminatore, director of the European Institute for International Relations. And finally, to all of you, supporters of peace tonight. I could introduce Steve Killelay to you by simply reading through his CV. This would be quite boring, not because of his CV, but because I suppose that you must have done this preparing your participation for today's conference, so you already read through his CV, I'm pretty sure. Steve, who I have the chance to know now for almost 2 years, is a person I got to discover, and I'm proud to be able to cooperate with. He's passionate, dedicated, and visionary. He's a visionary person who, although has an impressive resume, is an humble person wanting to bring out change. These basic ingredients created a talented businessman that eventually became very successful in all his endeavors. He's traveling around the world several times a year to present the products delivered by the Institute for Economics and Peace. He does this in order to convince and advise world leaders, heads of state and government, major investors, and policy and decision makers. His main goal is to promote peace by illustrating and emphasizing that the benefits of a state of peace are higher, both economically and socially, than a state of tension or conflict. He's a true leader, showing the way not only to people working for him, but to all those people he interacts with. He's someone that lives for his ideals and for the valid causes he decided to live for. In fact, he should not be with us tonight. He should not travel the world around the world all year long. He should instead enjoy beautiful Australia, travel for extended holidays, and enjoy his successes in life and a well-deserved retirement. But he decided to dedicate most of his time and other resources to the promotion of world peace. This is the reason why it was very easy for my colleagues and myself to dedicate some of our time to the organization of today's event and to you, Steve. After Steve's presentation, we will have a Q&A session moderated by Dr. Joachim Koops, director of the Global Governance Institute, that will also provide us tonight with his closing remarks. Finally, a refreshing cocktail will be offered in the Academy's cafeteria. But before that, I would like to invite today's speaker to the floor. Thank you all again for your numerous presence tonight, and wish you all a pleasant presentation and a fruitful discussion on the Global Peace Index 2015. Steve, the floor is yours.
Thank you for those kind words, Serge. Now, if you listen to my voice, you can hear it's very, very hoarse. So I picked up a head cold late last week and been doing massive amount of press interviews and talking, so the voice is gone. In fact, it was just a little croak yesterday, so it has come back. So bear with me. So it's very nice to be here, and thank you, everyone, for coming out in the rain. It's very much appreciated. So through. Ah, I recognise that face and the one before. Right. Okay, so the Institute for Economics and Peace was set up to study the intersection between business, peace and economics. Places special emphasis on developing metrics to measure peace. Two types of peaces we specialise in, what's called negative peace, which is the absence of violence or fear of violence, and that's what we use for the Global Peace Index. And positive peace, which is the attitudes, institutions and structures which help to create and sustain peaceful societies. We've also got other bodies of work which ascribe an economic value to changes in peace. And we've got a mechanism for being able to estimate the cost of violence for 162 countries around the world and aggregate that up so that we come to a cost for the global economy. And there'll be a little bit on that in this presentation. We also look at risk through having measures of positive peace, which is the potential for peace. Looking at actual peace, we can actually use it to calculate risk. And I'll have one or two slides on that further on in this presentation as well. So, if we look at the Global Peace Index, it's now in its ninth year, ranks 162 countries around the world, according to their relative states of peace. We use 23 different indicators, and these indicators are weighed on a scale of 1 to 5. Some of them are using logarithmic techniques, others using banding techniques. So it's the concept, methodology and the approach is developed by the Institute for Economics and Peace. We then have a set of experts peace and statistics who then determine what data sets we should use, or what measures, and what the weighing should be for each of those measures. Having done that, we then have another group, which is the Economist Intelligence Unit, which is part of the Economist Group in London. They then collate the data, and this creates a tripartite relationship where each of the groups has control over what they're doing. That creates a very, very robust development and a very, very robust output. So after the data's been collated by the EIU, it's then reviewed by the expert panel and us, we can make advice on where we think figures may need to be adjusted. But in the end, the EIU has control over what is accepted and what isn't. The expert panel has control over what's in the data sets and what's not. We have control over the actual overall philosophy and approach to measuring peace. So it's quite a robust way of developing an index. So it contains six measures of ongoing domestic and international conflict. They include things like the intensity of organised conflicts, number of deaths from conflicts, relationship with neighbouring countries. It's got 10 measures of societal safety and security. So these include things like the impact of terrorism, homicides and incarceration rates, number of police and number of refugees, and also the level of state-sponsored terror. We We've got seven measures of militarisation. These include military expenditure, number of armed surface personnel, ease and access to small arms, nuclear weapons capabilities, etc. The largest number of indicators of social safety and security, which are all measures, if you like, internal peace, and that's got the largest weighing in the index. So I'll come around, I'll just hit the highlights. We launched this in London on Wednesday. In Google News, when you went into the search, just on news articles which came out in the first 3 days, there were 69,000 references to the Global Peace Index. We look at the media reach, it was over 1 billion people. So there were articles carried by BBC World, The Guardian. We had it come out of Forbes magazine, New York Times, Der Spiegel, and I could keep going. Probably we had articles in somewhere, something like 100 different countries. So I think media reach this year was as good as we've had. And what I like about that, it does publish the concepts of peace, and it also does publish that peace is measurable, and that our actions should be gauged off what we can measure rather than what we think should happen. So one of the more fascinating facts for this year is that if we look at the peace, it's actually remained pretty much the same as last year. The movements are just so slight it's not worth mentioning, which is contradictory to what we can see happening in the Middle East. But there's a very, very clear explanation for this. We're seeing a growing level of peacefulness in the most peaceful countries, yet the least peaceful countries are becoming even more unpeaceful. And this has been going on now for the 8 years which we've been doing the index. And we'd call this an inequality in peace. And it's quite an interesting dynamic which we're seeing. And I'll talk a little bit more about it further on. However, we look, 81 countries became more peaceful in the last 12 months, 78 deteriorated. So you can see it's sort of on the edge. Deteriorations come from nothing which you wouldn't actually guess. So deaths from internal conflicts. So we look at deaths from internal conflicts. They've risen from 2010 from 49,000 up to 180,000 last year. So that's a 3.5 times increase. Terrorist activity, it keeps rising, and I'll talk about it a little bit further on. So that's, again, another disturbing trend. UN peacekeeping funding, that dropped this year, but that runs against an historical trend over the last 8 years where actually countries have been paying more of their dues for their peacekeeping operations, which is a positive sign. Counterbalancing these falls, there was a reduction in the homicide rates. If we look at the reductions in the homicide rates, they're probably related to change in the stats, which I'll come to. External conflicts fought, but obviously it's mainly based around the withdrawal of the forces out of Afghanistan and also out of Iraq, which has been going on for the last 5 years. But if we take a deeper dive into it, it's been replaced by internal conflict, which, as we know, has gone through the roof. Also, political stability has also improved slightly in the last 12 months as well. So, if we look at the bottom of the index, Syria is the world's least peaceful country. If we come to the top, Iceland's actually the most peaceful. Guinea-Bissau and Cote d'Ivoire show the largest improvements. In fact, Guinea-Bissau's pieces have been steadily improving over the last 4 or 5 years, which is pretty good sign, and Cote d'Ivoire's obviously on the back of the ending of the civil strife there, but it still suffers from terrorism. Libya and Ukraine, no surprise, had the largest drop. Ukraine had about 6,000 battlefield deaths in the last 12 months, but what's less known is there's now 1 million people which have been displaced inside the Ukraine, and we'll come to that in a little while too in terms of the number of IDPs. Europe's peace again improves. This is on the back of improvements last year and the year before. So, and Europe is the world's most peaceful region. Middle East and North Africa has now, for the first time, become the least peaceful region in the world. prior year it was South Asia. South Asia consists of Afghanistan, Pakistan, India and Sri Lanka. So if we went back 8 years ago, when we first started doing the indexes, the Middle East and North Africa was the least, was the fourth least peaceful region in the world. So that gives some idea just how far it's fallen over that period of time. So here's a map of the world, green being very, very good, red being very, very bad. So we look at the most peaceful nations in the world. They were Iceland, followed by Denmark, Austria, New Zealand, and Switzerland. Also in the top 10, there was Japan, Australia, and Australia. If we go to the other end of the index, you'll see at the bottom of it Syria, followed by Iraq, followed by Afghanistan, southern Sudan, and Central African Republic. If we look at this, you'll find that there's a certain areas of the world which tend to be the least peaceful. If you'll note, a lot of the countries are associated together in the central part of Africa. Then you go up to the Middle East, extending, and then also you move up into Russia and some of the related countries there. So let's have a look at the eight-year trends. So what we do in calculating this is we take a country average. So we take the peace, the 162 countries, add it all up together and divide by 162. There's another mechanism of doing this, and this is looking at personal peace. So you take the average peace for each person on the globe. Problem with that approach is because of... Hello? What's happened here? Magic? Do you think we've got magic? Okay. So if we look at the... and the way of being able to calculate the personal peace... So that's by taking the average of each person on the planet. But the problem with that approach is anything we do would be highly dependent on what happens in China and what happens in India because they've got over a third of the population of the world. So I'll just start talking and just reading off a few things here and while we wait for this to come back up. Hello. Oh, that looks a lot better than the speaker. That's all I can say. Right, maybe we're going to get there. Okay, I'll just keep talking because I'm just going to read off some simple stats so we don't need graphs for this part. So if we look at the safety and... So we've got three different domains, which I mentioned earlier on. So safety and security deteriorated by 3.85%. If we look at the military score, it improved by 2.4%. That was largely on the increase in funding for UN peacekeeping. Small decreases in the number of armed personnel globally and a small decrease in the percentage of GDP spent on the military. Ongoing conflicts deteriorated by 8.6% over that period. Now, so if we look over the 8 years, deaths from internal conflicts and the impact of terrorism accounted for the largest deteriorations. But again, we're back to this inequality of peace as some countries just keeping on improving. So we can see 76 countries improved while 86 actually deteriorated. The greatest deteriorations came in the Middle East and North Africa, obviously for the conflicts going on there, Central America and Caribbean regions, because increase in violent crime and increase in homicide rates. So, but fascinating thing, many countries in Europe had historically high levels of peace. And this is contrary to what a lot of people would think here. So we dug, and we looked at this over the 8 years, and so we dug a little bit more deep, and like this is an historic trend going on. So we went back 100 years, with homicides, went back 50 years with homicides. And countries like, let's say, Italy, France, Germany, their homicide rates now are lower than what they were 50 years ago, and which was the lowest after the Second World War, and lower than what they were 100 years ago. Although the 100-year-ago stats aren't quite as reliable. So I think in many ways they've got this inequality in peace. Whereas we now look at the bottom end of the index and it's stretched out further, so the least peaceful countries are far less peaceful than what they were a decade ago. So there's an interesting trend going on. So we look at the differences in internal and external peace scores. We can see the internal peace has sort of got worse and it's plateaued the last 2 years on average. The external peace has actually improved. Again, that's quite a lot of that's on the back of better payment for UN peacekeeping and also a shift from external conflicts to internal conflicts as well. So it's not quite as good as it may look. So if we look at the changes in indicators, again, we're back to the external conflicts as they've shifted to internal conflicts with the withdrawal of the various forces out of Iraq and Afghanistan. UN peacekeeping, we can see, has been improving for a period of time, but went off this year. If we go to the other end, refugees and IDPs have got the largest decrease. Internal conflict deaths have skyrocketed, as I mentioned earlier on, from 49,000 in 2010 to 180,000 in 2014. The impact of terrorism is also increasing, as is violent demonstrations over that period of time. If we look at deaths from terrorism, this gives you an idea of the curve. 2014 increase mainly happened in sub-Saharan Africa. So if we look at Nigeria, it went through the roof. There was a massacre of 2,000 people in Babu in Nigeria. That's probably the biggest one since 9/11. We also find that neighbouring countries like Niger are now getting caught up, as is Cameroon. Cameroon in 2013 had no deaths, had 191 deaths. 2014. Admittedly, a large number of them were in one airplane which was brought down. Total number of refugees are increasing. These figures are somewhat old. As we're sitting here today, latest figures which came out a week or two ago estimate that this figure is now at about 60 million. So as most people in the room would realise, that's the largest it's been since the end of the Second World War. And there's no sign that this number is going to decrease in the immediate future. If we look at places like the Ukraine, as I mentioned earlier on, 1 million people now have been displaced there. But if you go into Syria, the last time they did a census, 22 million people. What they estimate now is that somewhere between 9 and 13 million of those people are actually displaced, and like truly is a tragedy. If we look at the homicide rates, this shows them to you since 2005. We've gone back quite a way on this one. Out to, hang on, those figures at the wrong bottom, I think, wrong. I don't know what it's 2011, 2012. Should be 2013, 2014. Apologies for that. But what we're finding is that sort of the last couple of years there's been an improvement. A lot of that, we believe, is around statistical adjustments which made by UNODC, which have got a better calibration. So we're not, so at this stage we wouldn't say there's necessarily a trend in the reductions in homicides. It may just be a statistical abnormalities. We look at urbanisation and peace. We did a study on urbanisation and peace. If we look at the world today, it's about 3.5 billion people live in cities. Another 2.5 billion are going to move into cities over the next 35 years. And that's truly remarkable when you consider the number of people got in cities now. And that's really sort of taken a 200-year progression. What was startling for us, and at the end it did make good sense, but it was contrary to what I thought beforehand, is urbanisation actually leads to peace. So, if you think about the most peaceful countries in the world, and there, a lot of them are in Western Europe, they're also the most highly urbanised areas of the world. So, what we realised is if you look at urbanisation, it's a byproduct of development. So the higher the levels of development, the more urbanisation. So in theory, the more the world urbanises, the more peaceful it should become. But as we dug deeper down in the statistics, what we found, so there were three conditions present. Then urbanisation didn't lead to more peace over time. It led to more violence. And the first was if there was really poor rule of law. The second is if there was gross, there was group grievances, And the third is those high levels of inequality between the rich and the poor. So that was the basis for being able to understand it. Now, if we look where most of these people are going to come from over the next 35 years, they're going to be coming from the very low countries in peace and moderate countries in peace. So 1.9 billion people will come from those kind of environments. So as we look at this graph here, if you look at the black line running through it, that's the number of people living in rural environments. You'll note that it's actually a number of people living in rural environments has now plateaued and this will drop over time. If we look at the two yellow bars in the centre, they represent China and India and what the increase in urbanisation will be there. And if we look at the red thing going up the top, that's the overall increase of what we're going to see in urbanisation. So as you can see, it's a truly a massive ramp up. But the thing is that we can understand what actually causes the violence, then at least it's possible to develop policies to address it. If we look at the cost of violence to the global economy, we estimate that to be $14.3 trillion in 2014. And this represents just over 13% of the global economy. So what we do is we make individual estimates for 162 countries. Seeing we've got the Global Peace Index, we've got 23 different dimensions we measure. So 15 of those different measures we can actually ascribe an economic value to. And so that gives the ability about to build up a top-up approach to doing this. This allows for cost-benefit analysis of various interventions, various actions which might happen within these countries, or what the impact on the economy might be if there's changing levels of violence as well. So in a lot of ways it's very, very useful. So you could look at an example of that is you could look at the very, very poor countries. If you've got an increase in violence within those countries and that was spread evenly across the population, you can calculate the number of people who drop from living on $2 a day down to $1.25 a day. So that's one of the ways it could be used. So mentioned 15 measures. So if we look from 2008, the cost of violence to the global economy increased by about 15%. But what's quite interesting about that, that's approximately the same that the global GDP increased. So therefore we're seeing the cost of containing violence and dealing with the consequences of violence. Basically tracked with the rises in the global economy. So if we look at where do they come from, the conflict category accounted for a significant amount of these economic loss. So deaths from internal conflict were up 378%, as I mentioned earlier on. Losses from IDPs and refugees was up 260%. UN peacekeeping costs were up 166%. But what it'd say is that GDP losses from conflict were up 149%. But the UN peacekeeping up 167% still only accounts for 0.17% of the outlay and expense and or the impact of violence on the global economy. And deaths from external conflicts were down, but obviously offset by the internal conflicts. So I really like this diagram. It's pretty hard to see from there. But I'll point you to a couple of things. If we go right up there, that's basically UN peacekeeping operations. So we look at that compared to the size of it. Military by far is the largest. But what I'd really make a very clear comment here is we can count what we can count. There's a lot of stuff we can't count. In the military, there's very, very good databases on the expenses with it. If we could, my gut feeling is we're underestimating the cost of violence to the global economy by 50, possibly up to 100%. So the military expense would come right down on this chart if we actually had solutions to that. The other one which is really fascinating is up here is the size of the small arms industry. Just really small. But when we look at the small arms industry, we can only count the legitimate part of the industry. We can't count the legitimate part of the business, which will be going on in places like Somalia, Libya, and many, many other countries throughout the world. Now, what I'm going to do is talk about positive peace. So I think our view, the Institute for Economics and Peace, is positive peace is a transformational concept. Positive peace can be defined as the attitude, institutions and structures that create and sustain peaceful societies. So why is it transformational? I think the first thing is the way we've built up this is empiric. And I'll come to the approach we've taken earlier on. So generally when people talk about what creates peace, it's a set of personal impressions, it can be value judgments. The approach we've taken this has been driven purely by statistics, and that's what makes it unique. And what it does, it sort of reframes the study of peace towards what works. And I'll use some analogies here. So if we look at medicine, for example. So we look at pathology. It's really necessary to have better ways of being able to do operations, cut out cancers. It's really important, the study of it. Most of us here aren't going to die of a heart attack young anymore, and many cancers now are quite solvable, where it was a death sentence 30 years ago. So the study of pathology is really important. But you won't understand how to stay healthy unless you study healthy people. You won't learn that right exercise, good mental disposition, and a good exercise is what keeps you healthy through studying people on the deathbed. Similarly, if you wanted to have a great marriage, would you hang around the divorce courts to work out how? Probably not. So the study of what works throws up very different results from the study of what's not working. And the study of both is actually very, very important. So positive peace is also a measure of social resilience. And what we find is, and there's a good slide on this further on. So when we study societies which are strong in positive peace, they're able to absorb shocks. Examples of this would be Iceland, with the global financial crisis. It was the country most affected, went bankrupt. So, and it was able to adapt and it's gone on and still remains the most peaceful countries. Compare that to Greece. Also, if we look at the tsunami in Japan, like that truly was horrific. This society bounced, coped and came back. Compare that to Haiti after the hurricane which went through there. And positive peace also leads to other environments that many of us creates positive outcomes. So in some ways it describes somewhat of an optimal environment for human potential to flourish. And I'll hit a little bit more of that. So how do we arrive at positive peace? We take the Global Peace Index, which is actual measures of violence or the fear of violence. That creates the Global Peace Index. What we do then is we do analysis against different data sets, indexes and attitudinal surveys to find out what's most statistically significantly associated with it, and that way we understand what's associated with peaceful societies. We can now take that and turn it into an index, which we'll call the Positive Peace Index, and now from comparing that back to the actual peace of a country, you can make all sorts of analysis around risk, and I'll hit one slide on that. So developing the positive peace, we've analysed over 8,500 different data sets, indexes and attitudinal surveys. They cover things like macroeconomy, social relations and attitudes through polling data and surveys, economic and social development, economic and social integration, the functioning and structures of government, as well as their external relationships with other countries. So the data sets we've got are probably as comprehensive global data sets as any organisation in the world. So the Positive Peace Index, it ranks 162 countries, the same countries as in the Global Peace Index, which cover 99.6% of the population of the world. It uses 24 indicators on a scale of 1 to 5. It has 3 indicators for each of the 8 positive peace factors, which I'll cover in a minute. And the weighing is according to the strength of the correlation. So this is totally empiric in construction. It's got nothing to do with what any of the researchers think makes peace or even what I think makes peace. So we're totally driven by the data. So what does that data say? It means We've got eight factors which are really important. None of these will be counterintuitive. So they're things like sound business environment, well-functioning government, equitable distribution of resources, free flow of information, good relationships with neighbouring states, high levels of human capital, acceptance of the rights of other, low levels of corruption. When we look at this, these all come together as a system. So we don't look at causality here, rather the interplay between all the factors and creating strength in all the factors is what makes a system actually flourish. So, and quite often what's important is not so much where a country is, it's actually the pace of change and the momentum happening in the country. Is it moving in a positive direction or is it moving in a negative direction? And that we call positive or virtuous cycles, or what can be termed negative or destructive cycles. And what we find is when we look at these same factors, when together and they're strong, so positive peace, you get higher levels of GDP growth, so which means stronger business environments. Inflation is lower. They're more ecologically sound, so they perform better on measures of ecological management. Stronger business environments. The levels of human capital, as it, let's say, reflected through education, others is stronger. Forms much better on human development indicators, such as measures of gender equality and measures of well-being. So in many ways, as we describe this, it is describing an optimum environment for human potential to flourish. Now, this is basically the way positive peace looks around the world. Dark blue being good, light blue being bad. Again, you can see that Western Europe's strong in it. If we look at the top 10 countries, a lot of them don't come as too much of a surprise. So we see Norway, Denmark, Switzerland, Finland, Sweden, Netherlands, Iceland, Austria, New Zealand and Australia. Now, if we then look at the countries at the bottom, we find countries which we all know well, Iraq, Yemen, Equatorial Guinea, Southern Sudan, North Korea, Eritrea, Central African Republic, Afghanistan, Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Somalia. So all stressed out nations. Now, as I mentioned earlier on, you've got the Global Peace Index, the Positive Peace Index. So now, if you compare the two, you've got the ability to be able to look at the actual peace of a country and what, in theory, its peace should be. What we've found over time, countries fall back towards the mean. So in other words, countries which are more peaceful than what their attitude, institutions and structures say they should be, tend to fall over time. So we went back to 2008, took the 30 countries with what we'd term as the biggest positive peace deficit. Over this time, 22 of those countries dropped, 4 actually improved, and another 4 stayed approximately the same. So in terms of using it as a mechanism for being able to judge falls in peace, and as a predictive tool, it's not too bad. We've got other mechanisms to improve on that, which we're doing with a whole lot of risk factoring down in Sydney currently, but it's not in this release. The good news here is the positive peace has actually been improving. So we did a cut of positive peace in 2005, 2010, 2015. And what we found over that time is 116 of the 162 countries improved. Actually, only 13 deteriorated. And another way of being able to look at risk is those 13 which deteriorated. The ones which are improving are, over time, going on the right track. Now, this one's interesting, like this is really, really complicated, but and I could spend 20 minutes on it, but I'll only spend one. Only one part of it I want you to focus on, this part down here. So if you look at it, these are the most peaceful countries, and they're also the ones which are strongest on positive peace. And it tracks their movements in peace, there's a horizontal line so here over the last 8 years. You'll note that they don't move much. Big movement in Qatar, that's the only one. But when we get up to this end of the index, you can see they're moving all over the place. what that shows, that once you get to a certain level of peace, it's very, very sticky when combined with positive peace. You don't get a lot of movement. And that's the resilience coming through within these countries. Now, this is a scatter plot. It shows the relationship between positive peace and the Millennium Development Goals. So what we find with the Millennium Development Goals is that as countries progress in their positive peace scores, they're more likely to achieve the Millennium Development Goals, which shows again that these qualities are optimal for development. Now, this one's really, for me, probably really fascinating. So we had a look at a group of data on civil resistance movements going back over 40 years in time. And countries which are high in positive peace have less civil resistance movements. So these ones here are high in positive peace. The blue meaning they're non-violent movements, red meaning they were violent. So countries which are high in positive peace have much less civil resistance movements. These movements last for a less amount of time, a lot less likely to turn violent. They generally have less demands, and they're more likely to have some of their demands met rather than countries which are low in positive peace. This is because the adaptive qualities which are associated with those qualities which create for peaceful societies. And so this is quite interesting because that and the slide before it on resilience come back and they underscore the value of the model. Now, this is Myanmar. It just simply compares the changes in positive peace scores in Myanmar to the global averages. And it just gives you a very, very simple way you could use it to be able to sort of actually understand risk associated with a country. Now, in summary, measuring and analysing peace means you can understand the factors that create peace. If you can measure and analyse peace, then you can also understand the lost opportunity costs through not having peace. And this is actionable. It leads to better prediction, leads to better cost-benefit analysis, and better program outcomes. And that, my friends, is the end of this presentation. One horse voice. These are some of the other products we do. So we've got a whole range of products which we issue, like the Global Terrorism Index, various country analyses, detailed analysis on the economic costs of violence, as well as documents on positive peace and the relationships with corruption and peace. If you want more, you can go to the visionofhumanity.org and all this interactive maps there, and you can download any of the reports which I just mentioned earlier on. Thank you. That's the end of the presentation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you again so much, Steve, for this, despite the hoarse voice, fantastic presentation of a wide range of fascinating facts and figures that I hope we can discuss now in the Q&A session. Thank you also for allowing and inviting our institute again now for the second time to co-host this event. It's a great pleasure and great honour. I must say, both as a think tanker, but also as an academic, in addition to GGI, I also had a peace and security program at the Free University of Brussels. This index really now I've been using for 6 years. It is normally academics would have this skepticism and would start saying, but how do you come up with this figure? Let me see, where is your sources, where is the methodology? And I really invite you to go to the appendix, to the methodology, to see the amount, sheer amount of different indicators that this index is essentially a product, a compound product of. That in itself always is very, very impressive, and I always used it with big pleasure and stimulative effect with students, undergraduates and advanced students, to not only show them that when we study peace and security, it's not just a question of rule of thumb in terms of assessments, but also that you have to sort out your statistical skills if you want to be a successful student in that field. Now, with numbers, it's always a bit difficult if we looked at them isolated. Just a couple of things I wanted to pick up when I read the index and listened to your presentation. It seems to be that a big, big increase has been the deaths of as a result of terrorist attacks. 18,000, I think, was measured last year, which is quite, of course, an increase. The regional effect, last year we were here, we talked about Ukraine, which was all in our mind, and, of course, the destabilization of peace and security right at Europe's border. While the index still shows that Europe is still the most peaceful region, of course, the Ukraine conflict carries on destabilizing that. Interesting, what I thought also from the report from a European perspective is that five European countries did not make the top 40 of the index. And of course, I had to quickly check and find which five those were, and it's France, Greece, Malta, Cyprus, and Luxembourg. Luxembourg, I thought, surprising, but by Greece, I understand. Cyprus is clear. Greece, obviously, also as an effect of what you factor in terms of data and statistics on the what Johann Galtung would call structural violence, economic deteriorations, unrest now as a result of the financial crisis, and there you have the interrelation between economics and peace. Malta, I guess, might be interesting to see whether the impact of the refugee crisis of the Mediterranean has some sort of impact. France, I guess, as a result of the terrorist attack and Charles Hebdo. So it's interesting that apart from those five countries, European countries can be found in the top 20, top 30, top 40 of the index. What I always find surprising with this index, because I always think peace and security, we all also in the Royal Military Academy, I guess, we think about international conflict, we think about, you know, the big wars. But of course, the biggest indicator, as you always show in the index, is homicide, which we often seem to be forgetting about. And 500,000 on the global level is quite a number. And it's interesting to see how this is put in. What I then sometimes always do is try to combine and see a context of this. So I checked the deaths that year related to health issues. So I checked the US numbers, and for 2014, heart disease killed 611,000 US citizens, and cancer 584,000. So we see, of course, the correlation, but for us, it's not just the numbers of deaths. It's, of course, the important thing is preventable deaths. If enough peace measures, conflict prevention would have been deployed. And finally, I always find it interesting when you calculate the opportunity cost of conflict, this time 14 trillion, and I think that's almost the same as the public debt of the US states of America. So if we stopped having wars and conflict by tomorrow, we can also fix the US public debt, so that would be something. But enough on those numbers in comparison. Over to you. I'm sure you're burning with a lot of questions. I would bundle them, let's say, around five questions at a time, or six, and then we have, I think, time for two to three rounds. Please. Could you also please do us the favor and identify yourself, name and organization? That'd be helpful. Thank you.
Good evening. Alice Kokinos, Eurobolt.com. I just wanted to know if you include Ukraine in the European part of your statistics.
Hello, Nabila Habida from the European Peacebuilding Liaison Office. I had a question. I recently heard on from the Global Status Report on the Prevention of Violence from WHO that the most violent region in the world consistently is Latin America. So I was wondering how you could explain why you have different findings in the Global Peace Peace Index. Thank you.
Hello, good evening. Peter Hedling from the European External Action Service. I wonder, perhaps going straight into the action that you mentioned on the eight pillars of peace, what would you say is the main missed opportunities in EU foreign policy and international foreign policy if the approach is indeed to achieve peace, positive peace. Thanks.
Hi, Sofian Benashour with the Search for Common Ground. My question was around the data used. I see the number of the indicators focus on number of number of people killed or deaths, and I'm sure as you know that a lot of countries have a hard time to publish accurate numbers in terms of who was killed and how, especially when we're looking at rural conflicts or rural violence. And just a question of how you deal with getting the accurate statistics and how you figure that into the equation at the end of the day, because I'm sure it can have a significant impact when you're talking about those differences.
I think that's it for the first round then. So interesting, at least two on the statistics questions. Also, Ukraine, is Ukraine included in the European analysis? About the region of Latin America in terms of high level of violence. Then a politics question of the External Action Service, Peter, on missed opportunities of international European policies.
So if we look at the Ukraine, it's in Russia and Eurasia. So it's not included in it's not included in Europe. Thanks. We'll come back and hit the Latin American question. And you're right. If we went to Latin America, they've got the highest homicide, highest violent crime rates in the world. But for the index, that's only one part of it. I think one of the things about the index, which is innovative, is the concepts of taking those concepts of the internal peace of a nation, combining it with the external peace to come up with an overall view. So I think that's one of the things we've got which is innovative. We also can break it down by domains. So it's also possible to take it by societal safety and security. And you'd find, if we looked at that domain, you'd find that a number of the African nations and a number of the Latin American nations would be highest. From memory, Guatemala has the highest homicide rates in the world. I think that's at 86 per 100,000 population. Then you've got a number of other countries around there, like El Salvador, for example, which is around in the 40s. And then if you next stage, you drop down to be countries like Mexico, which I think is at about 28 homicides per 100,000. So that's sort of where it's at. But sort of what's happened in Latin America, if we look at it, if we went back to the 80s, though, particularly beginning part, a lot of civil wars going on, a lot of disputed borders. And towards the end of the 80s, they got their act together in terms of sort of being able to get a better working international relations. So that, compared to some other parts of the world, sort of what we can see, let's say, in Russia, certainly right through the Middle East, actually sort of has helped mute those high homicide rates. If we look at the stats, certainly a lot of the stats are very, very hard. So anyone who puts hand on heart and says, hey, I've got the exact number of homicides in the Central African Republic, well, not so right. So the construction of the index looks at taking this into account. So that's one of the reasons there's so many indicators, rather than just running with one primary one, because you could just run with something like homicide rates if you liked to sort of just look at a whole different aspects of violence. So we don't. So there's a combination of quantitative data. And there's other ones which are qualitative data estimated by experts, and so that's one of the reasons we use the Economist Intelligence Unit. They're one of the more authoritative groups in the world on this. They've got 100 analysts which cover the 162 countries, so they're quite experts in it. And there's a rigorous process for going about doing estimates like the level of violent crime, like the level of the violent demonstrations, and they're offset with quantitative data like homicide rates from the UNODC. But even that data then will be subject to expert assessment for areas where it may be considered to be wrong. So what I would say is everyone loves a ranking. So we do rankings, like a 100-metre race, for example. We're all very, very interested in who comes first, but the difference between first and fifth might be that much. Okay, so rankings, it's in our animal nature. So, But what I would say is that if we look at any one country, and so we can't say that the ranking's absolutely precise, but what we would say, it's not more than 10 places out than where it would be if you wanted to adopt some other way of looking at, or if the figures were enhanced one way or the other for any particular one or two indicators. So, but what it means is you've got to it's accurate enough to have a statistical base to be able to work with. But my background's actually business, and so you don't do anything without having KPIs and numbers. It's just the way you operate. And when I got into, first stumbled across that there weren't measures of global peacefulness, I was sort of shocked because the thing is, if you haven't got measures, you can't actually really understand something. You can't really analyze it in any scientific way. If you haven't got numbers, you don't know whether your actions are actually helping you or hindering you in achieving your aims because you're not actually measuring it. So even though we could do with a lot better data, what we've got does give us enough to work with statistically to be able to understand things like positive peace, is enough to be able to understand whether countries are improving, not improving, how they perform relative to their regions in the world, or how they perform relative to other countries which got similar sorts of structures. So take it on board that all stats aren't great. Now, we come back to the positive piece. I think what's transformational and what's unique about this is a lot of the time, if you look at developmental policy, it's focusing on one or two or three different things to try and bring about change. So there might be a big focus on rule of law in places with high levels of corruption. We all know the problematic nature of making interventions in other countries and trying to make changes. I think the thing with this is we view it as a system. So all of those eight factors or pillars, if you like, come together to form a system. They interact together. So how is corruption causal on well-functioning government? Or is well-functioning government causal on corruption? Is free flow of information, which is epitomised by free press, causal on low levels of corruption and causal on better government? Or is the government rules and regulations what creates a causal on a free press? It's really hard to disentangle. So focusing on the system is a different way of approaching things. So for me, the aspect of policy is now how do you take them and apply them to a particular concept, context. So I think one of the other things we quite often do is we start to sort of get one shoe fits all. So we'll have one approach which will then try and implement to fix everything. That gets very, very difficult. So I think when we look at these structures with these pillars for peace, all these factors which create peace, what you need to do is then look in the local context and see how do you apply them. So if you look at the local context, then you could look what would be an intervention you could do for each pillar, which would be substantial, which you could do within the current environment. There's a lot of things which would be great to do, but you could just never get them done because the dynamics of the local politics or the dynamics of the local culture. And then what could happen in the shortest amount of time? So if you can stimulate with an approach like that, if you can stimulate as many of the pillars as possible, you've got a mechanism now for actually creating or giving impetus towards a virtuous cycle. Because these cycles, as they get going, they're self-fulfilling. Sort of they create the impetus, so they move in a different direction. So as the system starts to improve, it's a little bit like it's a self-cleansing. It cleanses itself, becomes stronger. The economics then improve. That now creates more money to invest in education, health, better rule of law. Improve the corruption, and the thing keeps on moving forward.
Thank you. Should we open the second round? Starts with the top gentleman over there.
My name is Bruno. I'm with Innova Mais. We are participating in FORCE, a European project that seeks to combine the several contributions of several other European projects to foresee as a foresight mechanism. This is ongoing. I do have two questions. Looking at the map you presented us today, and thanking you very much for that, my mind wandered into the effects of bloc policy and if bloc policy may actually lead to peace, if there is any study to it, and as to involution. And if you don't mind, I would like to pose a second question, which is looking at one of your pillars. Thank you. Looking at one of your pillars, how would you comment on the dangers of inequality for Europe? Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Okay, second question, say quite one.
Any further questions? Please.
Hi, I'm Trip Zaninas from NATO. I have a question, and really when you were talking about your business background, it made me think, when you look at the data that you've collected here in this index, what predictive value can you extrapolate from that? And in particular, if you were to take a business metric and you were looking at investing in a company or the success of a corporation or an industry, how does that map onto the index here? And for example, major conflict regions where there's not conflict today, but there could be. So for example, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan are all relatively peaceful or very peaceful, but the conflict in the South China Sea obviously could become quite violent or lead to major conflict. So I just wonder what the predictive value of this index could be for future conflicts.
Yeah, no, good question.
Thank you. Any further ones? Okay.
So right.
Two more or less about foresight, I guess, no? Or
yeah.
Predictive value. Bloc policy, European inequality also, and then, yeah, the predictive value of your index.
So we'll start with the first one. First, the bloc policy and peace. I guess there does, in some ways, help with international relationships if you've got good relationships with neighbouring states. So I guess the best example in a lot of ways is the EU. So if we look at it really, and everyone in the room knows it, it starts out as an alliance for coal and steel, for the idea of stopping another war like the Second World War, then eventually develops into a much, much deeper bloc. So, and it'd be the most integrated group of countries in the world, by far, no doubt about that. And it's quite interesting that they're also the most peaceful countries in the world as well. So it's almost unimaginable that Belgium's going to go to war with any of its neighbours anymore. And just the free flow of people across the borders just helps to account for that. The highly integrated nature of the business environments helped account for that as well, and also the institutions. So now, from that angle, I think it's very, very positive. Now, if you take a bloc, which is actually an alliance with the opposite concepts in mind, now that would be probably dangerous on peace. So you could come around to Russia and look at its neighbours. Now, are those neighbours and that bloc there to try and destabilise other parts of the world, or were they there for a purely economic cooperative nature and also for a mutual defence nature? So I'll leave that one open. I'm not going to touch on that. But if we come around and look at other blocs, let's say like the African Union and such, or some of the blocs in South America, I think they generally have a positive effect, but there are negatives with it. We just saw the president of Sudan quite happily turn up in South Africa, and South Africa, as a sign of a African Union, let him go back home. So it means that the group as a bloc like that has the ability to be able to say, okay, well, we'll all act in unison to look after the people in our bloc. You've got free movement between our bloc and we won't worry about the rest of the world. Similarly, you can see a similar sort of thing out of the African Union towards the International Criminal Court. But on the other hand, it stopped a lot of the wars which were happening, raging between, not that they're over, raging between different countries in Africa, which were seen over the last 50 years. And you're getting much, much better economic cooperation. And as the economic cooperation improves, it lifts these countries out of poverty. And as they lift out of poverty, that has effect on a whole range of different social indicators around violence. We look at inequality. So we use the word equitable distribution of resources. And so what it's about is the social contract. So what a Swede would consider as an equitable distribution of resources and what an American would think is an equitable distribution of resources is a very, very different thing. Sort of many parts of the studies we do shows that actually poverty is not actually a driver necessarily of violence and conflict. What is high levels of inequality where there's no opportunity to get out of the poverty when it's there. So if you're walking down the street, you go past a restaurant, you're hungry, you look through an open glass window and you can see some people dining on lobster and you've never eaten lobster in your life. You know they're only there because of where they were born, family they were born into. You've got no chance of rising up. That's the kind of thing which leads to a lot of violence and conflict. So a lot of the time you've got to look at within the context of which it's in. Other thing too, which there's we've got to do more research on this, but also education. If people get highly educated and they've got the idea that their education should take them somewhere, and because of the inequities within the society, they're stuck and they can't get jobs. You build up all these expectations, and then the expectations aren't being met. So that also can lead to it as well. If we come back and we look at the predictive capabilities, there are a couple of very good questions. So we're working on models at the moment. So one of the things which there's a lack of, there's very good stats on a sovereign risk, not a lot of great stats on country risk. So that's one of the areas we're putting work in to try and address. So I've showed up there is a model, which is a simple model for predicting risk. We'd call that a positive peace deficit model. We've got other models which we've developed, which would be like country models. So how do you take countries with similar attributes within the region? How do those countries, how does the country compare to it in terms of its peace score? Is it higher or lower? How do the other countries in the region with similar positive peace attributes, how have they fared over time? And from that you can come up with some predictive things as well. So, but what we do is we're starting to work now with the concept of resilience. And so we draw analogies on that which we take out of, let's say, study of metallurgy. So a lot of it comes around in space back to construction. So what happens is nothing happens to a society, it'll pretty much bundle along the way it is, but it does get hit by shocks. So a shock can cause stress within a society, but the society then, given if the positive peace factors are strong, is the ability to adjust, absorb and change and take that shock in. So that'd be like Japan, let's say, with the tsunami. If the shock's stronger and or the positive peace factors aren't as strong, that can cause strain, which can then make the society somewhat more brittle. If it's a very brittle society, which we'd say is very low levels of positive peace, then smaller shocks will actually cause it to break and collapse. So to improve the positive peace, the shock has to be stronger to cause it to actually undergo real structural damage, if you like. So, but there isn't any society in the world if the shock isn't strong enough that the society will collapse. And we could think of a number like nuclear war, that'd be one. So, got to So our viewers were viewing it in terms of sort of the thing comes down to what are those likely shocks which could happen. And again, that comes back to country situational analysis to be able to understand it. Now, we're putting together, we'll be developing over time, over the next probably 12 months, website where people can go into and pick up a lot of the data we've got and a lot of other data sets and use it to develop mechanisms for being able to do risk analysis. And it's mainly aimed at sort of business, fund managers, multilaterals and sort of countries as well. So that they can actually look and be able to get a better idea of being able to assess risk. For business, there's different ways of being able to assess risk. So it was one, just in the last week, was a party to a conversation about business in Egypt. Okay, so a lot of countries have got investments in Egypt, had it for a long while because they saw it as a stable country. So a lot of the time, they're not so much interested in what we'd see as peace. They're more interested in stability. But the long-term effects, we know, can be catastrophic where it's a forced peace through an authoritarian rule. But once you're in, like if you've got big mining investments in a country, very, very hard to get out. You can't really change. And when you commit, you're committing for long periods of time. So there's a concept of risk-reward in this. So, like, the bigger the rewards, the more risk you're likely to take. Similarly, if the return and the payback on the investments in a shorter period of time, you're also likely to run higher risk as well. And again, it'll come back and depend on the type of business which you want to do, which will be determined by the level of risk within the society as well. So it's complex, comes back looking at each individual country, but that's the way I'd be starting to think about it. What's the risk-reward opportunity for it? So an example of that, you might want to invest in a telco. So what generally happens if you're a hedge fund manager or a mutual fund or something like that, you usually don't do the risk as the first thing. You're usually going out and trying to seek out investments, and you might decide that the telco industry is an industry which is going to grow globally. So you'll now hunt around for where you think the best opportunities and the biggest growth for telcos are going to be. Now, having done that, you'll then sort of put them into models and you'll work out what the likely profitability of those ones would be. And then at the back end of that, you'll bring in the country risk, and that will determine and sway you which way you might make an investment.
Steve, many, many thanks. Serge is indicating that, unfortunately, we're slowly running out of time, at least on the formal aspect. We're going to then move to the informal reception outside for a drink and hopefully some more interesting conversation. By way of concluding, I know Serge said, supposed to do some concluding remarks, I think what I would like, by way of conclusion, is maybe ask you two things. The first one, and it picks a little bit up on a question that was asked, actually, but I think we didn't answer it, is where from here now? So we have the data, we have the treasure trove of correlations, potential correlations. Do you feel in the last 7 years that there has been a policy impact? Do you think, I mean, you mentioned, for example, that this index has a big impact on the media, on educational, mass education, academic education, students read it with interest, you get traction in many countries. But how about policymakers? Maybe you could let us a little bit know whether you were in touch with policymakers. We've got representatives from NATO here, EU. Do you think this influences their policies? That'd be interesting. And secondly, maybe, what is your most single important takeaway from the index? Because, I mean, it's of course, a very dense report. Or maybe what figure surprised you most? Where would we say, okay, this is definitely the one-liner to end it with?
Right. Well, maybe we'll save the one-liner for the last thing. Okay, so where to from here? So we're in the process. We're going to develop a European peace index. We want to take this down to what's a statistical level of a NUTS 2, NUTS 3 level. So that's down to about 10,000 to 100,000 level of population. What we'll do then is take what census data and other socioeconomic data we've got, compare it back to these levels to try and understand, from a statistical perspective, what are the various factors associated with peace within the European Union. Within Europe, so it's broader than the European Union. We're up at one of the groups within the European Union today discussing this. They were really enlivened by it. I was meant to be in the OECD tomorrow discussing on how you go about doing multidimensional country analysis, but I pulled out of it because of my voice. I just got arrested tomorrow because I'll be in the UK the following 2 days with a group of military representatives from six different countries looking at how they can use non-lethal techniques to improve peace in the operations which they do. Because I think at the back of what's going on in the Middle East at the moment, we're all realising, although the military is very, very important for bringing law and order, bringing order to places, there's a lot more which needs to be done to create lasting peace. I think that's the big lesson, let's say, from Iraq and Afghanistan today. So that'd be another area. We're putting on, would you believe, a positive peace conference at Stanford University in a couple of months. That'll be the first positive peace conference of its type anywhere in the world. So that's quite good. The World Bank actually is looking at having their fragility conference next year and having it around positive peace. So that'd be another example of a breakthrough with that. We've worked with the UN. We work closely with them on the development of Goal 16 for the Sustainable Development Goals, which are the follow-on from the Millennium Development Goals. Goal 16 is the Peace, Security and Justice Goal. Peace, Governance and Justice Goal. So a lot of that, we can see our work is sort of implemented with that. Our work's probably taught in over 1,000 university courses around the world. It's not a whole semester on it, but it's in some shape, way, or form. It's included in thousands of courses now. So that'd just be some of the things for the impact. So I guess the thing which might I've got two one-liners which I took away from this one, which I didn't realise. So the first is that inequality and peace, the way it's stretching. The top's becoming a lot more peaceful, the bottom is becoming a lot less peaceful. So that's the first thing. That's the first thing, that stretching of the rubber band, if you like, which is global peace. The second point, I always would have thought that urbanisation was associated with increases in violence. Okay, that's really what I had in my head. But when we did the statistical analysis, we're seeing something different. That doesn't mean that the increases in urbanisation over the next 35 years won't be associated with increases in violence. But it's a generality, when they got the right factors there, urbanisation leads to peace. And look at the countries we live in. They're the most highly urbanised countries in the world, and they're the most peaceful.
Important message. So people from the countryside, Walloon and Flanders, move back into Brussels. That's the key. That's the key message. Steve, thank you so much again for this, and especially you and the Institute for Economics and Peace. I can really say for this fantastic peace index. As with every index, it's not the definitive answer. It's the beginning of further questions, further testing, further debates, and I really hope that you do download the entire report, which takes some reading, but is really worth going beyond just the summary. So thank you so much. In the name of the co-organizing institutes, who are themselves very eager to use the data for their further projects, in the name also, of course, of the attendees today, let me thank you warmly, and also let me thank all the attendants for coming tonight, contributing with your questions, and making this a very stimulating event. Thank you very much.